Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Solo Cast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Apple bias. Today is Tuesday, May 29th, 2018, and this is show number 681. Well, thanks for waiting for us to get back from Memphis for the holiday weekend. It's kind of lonely here. I'm doing this without the live audience, and I know it sounds funny because I can't see them and I can't hear them when I'm doing the live show, but I know they're there because they're chattering away over in the corner. Well, the most recent Chit Chat Across the Pond was an interview with a young woman named Lupita Salazar. Lupita is a hardcore geek with a love of tech that is so deep she switched to Android for a year just to learn everything about it. Of course, she switched back to the iPhone after that. Anyway, Lupita is also blind. She talks in the interview about the tech she uses, but also how unfortunate it is that we don't insist on Braille literacy for the blind as children. It's interesting and fascinating to hear her perspective on that. She's a really delightful person, and I enjoyed talking to her quite a bit. You can check it out at Chit Chat Across the Pond, episode number 548, in your podcatcher of choice under Chit Chat Across the Pond or Chit Chat Across the Pond Lite. Let's play the last of our NAB interviews here. I know Steve says I really milk these, but I save them for when I need content. And of course, it turned out this week I have lots and lots of content because of the contribution of some great listeners. Let's listen to that last interview. Well, every year at NAB, Steve and I like to stop by the Audio Technica booth, mostly to gush about how amazing the products are that we're already using. And so I'm here with Gary Boss from Audio Technica. Right now, my favorite Rode mic is my ATR2100, and you are hearing me now from the System 10 microphone that is a digital microphone that broadcasts to Steve's camcorder, and he's got the receiver up there, and as you can hear, the audio is amazing out of this thing.
Yeah, it's one of those systems that we really like. Not only because of the sound quality, because of the ease of use. So wireless were always kind of that mystery. You had to look up on the website and put in your zip code and figure out where you're going to be and set your frequencies. Well, the world doesn't work like that anymore. We're used to turning on our phones and they work. I don't have to tell it where I am. So this is one of those wireless that literally does all the heavy lifting for you.
Yeah, so it auto switches the channel for us. If I'm on a frequency that isn't has a lot of interference, it'll auto switch both of us, right?
Yeah, and the beauty part is it's silent. You never know what's happening. So when you turn that on, it does all its magic and it scans the environment and sets the frequency at the transmitter and the receiver, and it will actually do that as necessary during a broadcast.
While recording, it'll switch.
Yes, without ever knowing it or hearing it. It has no audible switching. It just works. And that's what things are supposed to do, right?
Yeah, well, if this works at CES with all the interference there, this is pretty amazing. One of the things I really like about you guys is you have high-end stuff at $3,500 microphone,
yep.
Right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But then you also have stuff for our audience. How much does the System 10 go for nowadays?
System 10 with a full system with either a body pack and a lavalier or the handheld that you have is about $450 out the door.
Okay, I didn't think we paid that much, but we didn't get the full system, I think. So
maybe, yeah.
I don't think we got the pack and such. But anyway, definitely within affordable for Rode mic kind of work for doing interviews just like this. But you want to show us something specifically for iOS devices, correct?
Yeah, so, obviously the buzzword out there is content creation. We don't really know what that means because pretty much everything is content.
What isn't content?
Right, exactly. But we kind of narrow it down to podcasts, streaming, YouTube video creation, things of that nature. And we have a really unique microphone. So, obviously, we were very big in wired microphones. And then as the USB trend, we were one of the forefront of that with a USB output microphone, digital output microphone.
Like the ATR2100.
Exactly. And so what we have too is we've adapted that with the AT2020 USB-I, obviously with the I, not so creative on our model numbers, but it really gets you in the ballpark to know.
It's iOS.
Exactly. So we have a USB cable, which is traditional, but we also have a lightning connector. So we can go native right into an iPhone or an iPad and record one device into your iPad. You're making podcasts in your hotel room on the road and a very high quality.
Wow. So we're looking at here, this is an audio podcast, but also obviously on video here. So the ATR2020 USB-I is $199. Looks like a super professional microphone here. Looks really nice. Dark black.
Yeah, this is actually based on one of the best-selling side address studio microphones in the world called the AT2020. So it was a matter of putting the digital output on that and then making it iOS compliant.
So we've got, what is that? Is that USB B? USB B on one end.
Look at it right there. We got that. And then you get...
Oh, micro USB. Yep. Okay.
And then you get two cables it comes with. It comes with this. So the micro USB to US standard USB and then the micro USB to Lightning.
Ah, so you supply the cables as well. That's fantastic.
Yep. And it shows up just as a native audio device in your device. And this is a recording we did in the office of just a quick little little speech.
So he's got a speech playing on here in Twisted Wave on an iPad, and I listened to it. Steve listened to it. Sounded absolutely fantastic. The guy doing the recording had a great voice, but it is clean. It's a beautiful recording, and that's $199, right?
Yep. Available kind of everywhere.
Okay, so I haven't ever talked to you about headphones. Let's go walk over to the headphone side.
All right, let's do that.
All right, what do we have over here?
So one of the things, Audio Technica is a 50-year manufacturer. So we've been around for quite some time. And one of the things we specialize is what they call transducers. So that's anything that takes one form of energy and translates it to another. So we started with phono cartridges. You wiggle a needle and it produces electricity. Headphones.
How those worked.
Yep. Headphones do exactly the opposite. You feed them electricity and they wiggle and they produce audio, right?
It's moving a magnet in there with a coil.
That's correct. And that's what the microphone's doing. So that's kind of our core competency. So we got our start in headphones. We're the largest manufacturer of headphones and seller in Japan. So obviously we're very big into the headphone market in the U.S. And not only is that on the consumer side of things, but what we have here, which is the professional headphones. So the nice thing about this is these are all monitor headphones. They tend to be tuned a little flatter so you can get a real accurate representation of your audio. And we have price points from $49 all the way up to $349 in our headphones. So we kind of have a price point to suit all budgets. And then as you go up through those headphones, you get different feature sets, detachable cables, maybe a little better isolation, maybe a little bit more the low frequency response, but they're all very geared towards that professional audio user.
See, so I'm not a great audiophile. I care mostly about comfort.
Right. So all of ours have removable ear pads. Obviously, being a manufacturer of headphones for 50 years, we know a thing or two about fit and finish. So we definitely go through a lot of iterations to make certain we have very comfortable. Because these are made for professional users. They may be mixing either a live show or editing audio or video and maybe have them on for 6-8 hours at a time. So
the top of my head starts to hurt after a while from that.
Well, that can happen, but you know, these were made to have ample cushioning in the top. And in fact, the newest headphone we have here, you feel it? Squish it. So this is actually memory foam ear pads, memory foam headband, and this is called the ATH-M60X. This is a little more expensive headphone. This is $199, and this is an on-ear design. So this is our first on-ear. But again, they have detachable cables. Let's see, you roll over the cable with your office chair.
Don't throw away the cable.
You can replace that, and it comes with three cables. So it comes with a long cable, a long coiled, and then a short one for personal listening.
Oh, I like that. So I got to tell you, the reason I would unplug that would be to disentangle it.
Yeah, that's a biggie. Or if you need to travel, it's much easier to take the cable off, and then you can wrap that up separately.
Wrap it separately. Now, there's a little wiry thing coming out of here. What is that?
That's so you don't steal it at the trade show.
Oh, okay. So, wow, there's some crazy antenna there.
Nope, that's just a security device. Although we trust all of our users implicitly.
Of course.
Some more than others.
Yeah, you shouldn't have trusted me. So this model you just showed me is the ATH-M60X professional monitor on-ear headphones.
Yeah, that's the newest member of our M series. The thing that's interesting, we have this M50. That is by far and away the best-selling headphone that we've had in our line in our history. It hits a perfect ratio of price point to sound quality to comfort. So that is being used by both consumers and professionals alike. So when we designed this M60 on ear, we actually utilized the same driver as this M50 in there. So,
oh, okay. But they look smaller, a little lighter?
Yeah, they are. Like, a lot of people do prefer that on ear design. So we wanted to give those customers an option as well.
So this is, so the M60X is on ear and the M50X is over ear.
Yeah, and technically, the technical term for that is circumoral.
Just so circumoral. You know. I do want to be saying everything right. And then the ATH M30X. X is your $69 model, and that is intraoral. No,
circumoral.
Circumoral.
Yeah, those are all what they call over ear, which means that they seal around your ears and they go over your ears.
Okay, great. Well, this has been fantastic, Gary. I really appreciate it. I will come by and gush at you guys every year, especially if I get that ATH M60X for my birthday in a couple weeks. I'm just saying, it could happen, right?
You never know.
All right, thanks a lot, Gary. We'll see you again next year.
Thanks for stopping.
Well, this might be the tiniest tip I've ever put on podfeet.com. If you have external monitors hooked up to your Mac, it's really awesome most of the time, because sometimes it just gets confused. Well, you probably know that in System Preferences, you can identify which display is the main monitor, meaning that's where apps first open and things like that. Well, it's an odd little trick to get this to work. And you open System Preferences, go to Displays, click on the Arrangement tab, and on that screen, you'll see all of your monitors portrayed and the way they're physically aligned. If the representation of your monitors are not arranged the same way they are in physical space, your cursor won't slide between them properly. For example, if your external monitor is to the left of your Mac's internal monitor, but in Displays Preferences, it's on the right, your cursor simply can't move across between the two properly. You'll find yourself banging into the edge of the screen, not able to get to the next one. You can slide the representations of your monitors up and down, right and left, to mimic the physical arrangement of your real monitors. When you get it just right, your cursor will slide nicely between them. Now, only one monitor has a little white bar at the top. Drag that white bar to a different monitor to make it the main monitor. All monitors will have a menu bar, but that little white bar is what tells macOS which monitor is really in charge. But that's not the tiny tip. That's just to make sure you guys knew that part first. The problem to be solved by this tiny tip is that sometimes the app switcher, the thing that you invoke with Command Tab, it gets confused and it doesn't come up on the main monitor. It simply picks a different one. I don't know what causes this, but it happens pretty often to me. There's a very easy little gesture to fix it, and it's completely unintuitive. On the monitor where you want the app switcher to appear, bring your cursor down to the dock, or if your dock's on the left or on the left-hand side, bring it to the left. On the far right of it, when it's down in the bottom, is the trash can. To the left of it, you may see some icons if you have any app windows minimized, but keep going to the left of the trash and you'll see a thin vertical line separating it from your applications. Put your cursor over that vertical line and your cursor will turn into a double-ended arrow. This double arrow is intended to suggest dragging up and down. If you drag down, the dock will get smaller, and if you drag up, the dock will get bigger. Something else wonderful happens. When you hit Command Tab after you do that, it will now bring the app switcher up on the right display. I told you this was an odd little tip and the tiniest little tip I've ever done. I'm sure by now you've noticed a rather significant uptick in the emails that you're getting. 95% of them are with titles of Our Updated Privacy Policy. Hopefully by now you've listened to Bart Bouchat's excellent walkthrough of GDPR on Chit Chat Across the Pond number 534. This is all about the European Union's new General Data Protection Regulation, and that's what's behind all of these lovely emails. Bart explained many features of GDPR, but one of them is that companies that have customers in the EU must have clear and readable privacy policies, sort of the opposite of lawyer speak. There are also new rules about opting in versus opting out of having your data collected. In the old days, when GDPR was just a twinkle in the EU's eyes, companies could opt you into a service or trick you by having the opt-in button pre-checked. That option is no longer allowable. And that's why you're going to notice that many of these communications have a big button begging you, please opt into our newsletter, please, please, please. If you don't opt in, they have to erase your data from their database and stop bothering you. It's really pretty delightful. I think a lot of us have been going, woohoo, getting off of that one without even knowing where it came from. Well, I'm bringing all of this up just to give you some background. I, too, have jumped on the GDPR bandwagon. While I do have a website that has visitors from the EU, it's highly unlikely that the EU would ever come after a little old podcaster like me. But that's not the point. The point of GDPR is to give people back control of the information that is collected about them. And how could I in good conscience be against that and not try to do it myself? So I did a couple of things, and I'm going to give a big shout out to my service providers for making it really easy for me to do this. I use a content management system called WordPress to create the look and feel of podfeed.com and to store all of the glop that I type into it and the comments you write on it. In this last couple of weeks, a new version of WordPress came out, which of course I install immediately because I stay patched and stay secure. To my surprise, a little fly-up window came on screen that offered to help me write a privacy statement. How cool is that? Now, I knew there were things I wanted to say about how I, as a human, take care of what information you give me, but I didn't have a really good understanding of how WordPress handles things like cookies and such. Luckily, that information was in the easy-to-read boilerplate language that they provided to me. I added my flavor to the text WordPress gave me, and I was done with the privacy policy. I was able to add my new shiny privacy policy to the header menus, so you can always go check it out. And I wanted to tell you, though, about a few things I learned and a few things I added to that page. Let's talk about comments first. When you guys add comments on the blog, evidently WordPress collects your IP address and browser's user agent. For example, are you using Safari, Chrome, Firefox, whatever. They do this to help in spam detection, they say. I have to be honest here, with that feature combined with a plugin I use called Akismet, I get maybe two spam email or spam comments, I should say, a month. It's absolutely wonderful. In fact, two is probably more than I get. It's really, really infrequent that I get bothered with spam comments. Now, WordPress also stores an anonymized hash of your email address to see if you use the service Gravatar. That's if you enter your email address. That is an option on my website. You don't have to put it in, but if you put it in, it checks it and it says it does this anonymized hash and it checks this service Gravatar, and that's what gives some people a nice avatar in the comments like mine. No need to use it, but it's something kind of fun. Well, in the comment section, I added more information about that. When you leave a comment, like I said, you can choose to add your name and email address. Totally voluntary. But it is kind of handy because that way sometimes I need to tell you something, like if you posted it twice, or I might have edited something you wrote because there was this major typo that I'm sure you would have wanted fixed. I might do that, but I would always let you know. But let's say at a later date, you don't want your email address stored by me. It's pretty easy for me to search for you by email address in WordPress, so I can easily delete all of your comments if you needed me to. You never know when somebody needs to go silent on the internet, and I would never stand in the way of doing that. When you put your name, email, and address, email address and website into the comment form, this data also gets saved using cookies. They say that when you come back to write another comment later, you won't have to log in and the cookies are saved for a year. I wonder about that, though. I have to log in lots of times to leave comments on my own site, so I'm really not sure about that part. Now, under analytics, there's a section in the boilerplate with a title that says, "Who we share your data with." Well, that's just a boilerplate heading. It doesn't have any data underneath that, so I had to fill it in. Well, guess what? I don't share your data with anybody. Not for free and not for compensation, for sure. That'd be gross. I wouldn't do that. Another part of the privacy policy is this opt into the communications thing. You may have heard me talk about the Podfeet Press. This is a newsletter that's mostly auto-generated and announces when the new shows get posted. So like today, when I'm doing one on a Tuesday, you're going to notice that you get an email on a Tuesday, totally different than the normal Sunday one. Well, I say it's mostly auto-generated because sometimes when something weird happens, I also use the Podfeet Press to tell people, like if I'm not going to do a live show on Sunday night. Sometimes I remember to do that. Let's say if my website goes belly up, I might want to tell you about that. Or if I've got laryngitis. That has happened, and that's the kind of thing I might do an out-of-band notice on using Podfeet Press. Now, compared to the average statistic the service MailChimp gives me, the open rate for this newsletter is unusually high. It's in the mid-40%, and they say that the open rate is normally like 2%. So that tells me evidently most of the people on the list like getting it. Now, even though you had to click on the Podfeet Press link in the menus on podfeet.com, and even though you had to voluntarily put your email address and request to receive it, the GDPR is requiring that people get the opportunity to opt in yet again. So it was probably overkill for me to do this one, but when I found out that MailChimp had created an automatic way for me to ask you, I thought, why not? I added my own particular flavor of silliness to it. I called it All the Cool Kids Are Doing GDPR, of course. The only thing that I don't like, and I don't think I could have controlled, at least I didn't figure it out, is that once you hit opt-in, you get taken to a page that asks what kinds of emails you want from me, including marketing messages. Well, I don't ever do that, so that's not really an option. I only use your email address for the purposes I mentioned, never for any kind of marketing. But hey, if you want off the list, this sure makes it easy. And the last thing I want is to bug you guys. I only want people to get Podfeet Press if they want to get the Podfeet Press. The bottom line is I found it really interesting to go through the process of following the GDPR rules. I'm glad I went through the effort to give more transparency to everyone. I've now gotten a notice. I mentioned earlier, Akismet is how I block spam emails, and they have a special thing they're saying I need to add to my privacy policy about Akismet. So I still have one more thing I need to do. But anyway, I'm excited that I followed along with the spirit of GDPR on podfeet.com. Speaking of cool kids, do you want to be awesome like Brad Cadle? Well, Brad evidently finds joy out of the Podfeet podcast, so he went to podfeet.com/Patreon and he pledged a weekly dollar amount to help support the production of the shows. Well, I do this for the love of the subject. You know I'm never going to stop. Anyway, it does help to pay for the hosting and servers and software and hardware that Steve and I use to produce the show if you can help us through Patreon. If you find value and you'd like to help out, please check out the Patreon model and see if it's right for you and your family. There's about a million ways you could get there. I told you podfeet.com/Patreon, but there's also a button on podfeet.com that says, I think it says help the show, something like that. Anyway, if you follow that, there's a button at the very bottom of podfeet.com that shows you, will take you right into Patreon. So I hope you'll go check that out.
Hi, I'm Sandy and I'm a quilter. Okay, now that I have that out of the way, what does that have to do with a tech podcast like this one? Other than the fact that many sewing machines these days are computerized, yay, there are many applications that make designing quilts so much easier than using pencil and graph paper. With the latter, one mistake, one time changing one's mind, means that you must have a very good eraser or start all over again. However, there's now software for designing quilts, including giving lists of how much fabric to use and rotary cutting instructions. It used to be that this software, called Electric Quilt, or EQ, was only available for Windows machines, which meant installing a virtual Windows machine onto our Macs. Ugh. However, a few years ago, the EQ people began offering a Mac-native version too. Phew, I no longer have to use Windows for anything, which makes me very happy, since I'm really not comfortable in that environment. Okay. So how does this all work? Upon opening the application, you have the choice of designing a quilt from scratch, starting with a quick quilt project, which is a layout already designed that you can then modify, or you can open a project that you've acquired from another EQ user. If you've opted to design a new quilt or modify an existing one, you can select a layout, which involves selecting how to align rows and columns of blocks, whether straight or on point, as well as choosing the size of those blocks, whether or not to have sashing, which are strips of an alternate fabric, between those rows and or columns, whether to have borders around the whole, and the size and numbers of those optional borders. There's a block library included from which you can choose the ones you'd like to use, but you can also design your own blocks. What if you prefer applique to piecing? You can draw those shapes too. You can color both pieced elements and applique elements to your heart's desire, which is a huge advantage since it allows experimentation without wasting fabrics that you might later regret having chosen. Finally, you can print out cutting charts or templates, fabric requirements, applique shapes, and many other handy and or essential parts to the quilt. I like to print out the informational parts to PDF and use them on my iPad. Does this all sound terribly complicated for little old ladies? Possibly, but it's no more complicated than setting up email or any of a number of other things we might use. Besides that, not all quilters are little old ladies. Just think of all the options we have in a word processing application. However, there's also very good tech support from the people at EQ, as well as a detailed manual inside the program. Do you prefer a hard copy book? You can order that separately, as well as other optional reference materials. This fantastic software is available at http://electricquilt.com. We quilters have come a long way.
Well, thank you so much for that, Sandy. You know, guys, Sandy was worried that that was a little too much of a niche product, but I think that's kind of what makes up the NoSilicast. Not everybody cares about photography. Not everybody cares about music. Not everybody cares about security, but you should. No, I'm not allowed to use the word should. Anyway, you know, there all the different types of technology that we're using, it makes it really interesting to understand what's available. And I think this fit in perfectly. And thank you so much for sending that in, Sandy. I'd like to start this particular review by saying that the customer support representative who refunded all of our money was awesome. I might give you a little bit of an indication of how Steve and I feel about the Explore Bike Share service. We were in Memphis for the weekend, like I said earlier, and we had walked a fair bit of the city. And when we saw the opportunity to rent electric bikes, we thought that sounded really fun. We'd been wanting to try an electric bike, and renting one seemed like a great way to do it. Being able to ride for a while and then drop off the bike at another station would be really ideal for touring the city. Explore bikes have solar panels to charge, a nice dorky basket to carry your stuff up front. They have two ways you can rent, either through a kiosk with a credit card or using the B-Cycle app on your phone. We really didn't want to mess around with downloading an app before finding out if this is something we wanted to do again. So I started poking the touchscreen on the kiosk, and it was one of those annoying ones that doesn't respond very well to every touch. When it finally did respond, I got an error screen that looked a lot like Chrome talking, where it said, "This page isn't working. Localhost is currently unable to handle the request. HTTP error 500. There was a reload button, but the screen had decided it was on vacation now and wouldn't respond at all to our touch or poke or smash or pound. Not that I did any of those things. Okay, well, fine. Can't use the kiosk. Guess we have to download the B-Cycle app. I know it makes sense since we're renting an expensive device, but we were still annoyed that we had to create an account, choose a password. It was one of those ones where it only prompted once, so no password matching to make sure you got it right. And then we had to give it our phone number and our credit card number. Now, it's just that if we had been able to do it with the kiosk, we would have stuck in the credit card and been done, right? Anyway, it didn't have any kind of 1Password integration, so it was a whole lot of wiping back and forth and copying and pasting. Finally, we had our accounts, and we were ready to go. Then the app asked us to log in. Okay, fine. And guess what? The app said my password was wrong. Seriously? Well, when I created it in the app, I copied it from that account setup screen, and I pasted it into 1Password. When I was prompted for the password, I went back to 1Password, copied it, and pasted it back into the app. I never typed it but that one time, so I knew I had it right. Okay, so I initiated a new password request, and it rather quickly sent me an email reset link, and I pasted in the same darn password I'd asked for originally, and this time it said, "Oh, I like that one. I'll let you keep it." All right, whatever. While I was doing the password reset dance, Steve had started to rent a bike. Process is fairly straightforward. There's a touchscreen between the handlebars of each bike. When you tap it, a 6-digit code comes up on screen. In the B-Cycle app, you tap on an icon of a bicycle, and ad asks you how long you want to rent the bike. 1 hour was $5, and since we only had 1 hour to play, he picked that option. The app prompted him to enter the 6-digit code from the bike, then it told him he had 10 seconds to unlock the bike. Well, the bikes are physically locked to the bike stand with a giant U-shaped bar. Steve began wrestling with his bar, and after a considerable amount of yanking and jiggling, he was able to pull it loose. So now he's got a bike, and he's got this giant U-shaped bar in his hand. He had to do something with this U-shaped metal bar. He realized there were still holes in the bike, and since he would need it when we put the bike back into a new bike rack, he figured it needed to go with us, so he inserted it into the holes in the bike. Now, if any of you have ever done this before, you will realize this was a critical failure of process, because what he did was locked the bike again. So now he can't ride it, and he can't put it back. Now, to be fair to the Explore Bike Share people, they did put instructions in the dorky basket up front, explaining how to insert the U into the holes in the basket. But remember, Steve wasn't yet sitting on the bike, so he hadn't looked in the basket when this happened. All right, so now he's got a bike out of the rack, but it's locked. He went back into the app, and it had not gotten the message that the bike was locked, so instead of giving him a screen to unlock it again and pay another $5, it was suggesting some lovely paths in downtown Memphis for a bike ride. The only option we could think of at this point was to have me unlock the bike with the app on my phone. We figured, you know, it's going to cost us another $5. At least we'd be able to get riding a bike. We successfully entered the 6-digit code on my app and the bike unlocked. Steve was able, again, with some difficulty, to wrestle the U-shaped bar loose and put it into the holes in the basket. Okay, so we have now successfully paid $10 to rent one bike. All right, now I need a bike. Well, Steve's app still thought he was on a ride, and now so did mine. Turns out the B-Cycle app would not allow us to rent a second bike on either of our phones. This is kind of weird, right? How would you rent one, say, for you and a kid, or somebody who didn't have the app or didn't have a credit card? I don't know how that works. Well, at this point, Steve found an option in the app to call customer service. A very nice and capable woman, I wish I'd remembered her name. Anyway, she confirmed that the system knew Steve's bike was unlocked and that it was my account that was on a ride. Luckily, by this time, Steve's app had gotten out of its funk and it told him it was ready to let him rent a bike. Our new little friend walked Steve through how to rent the bike again, but this time rent him a discount code over the phone to give him a free ride. So now we'd only be out $10, right? He used this code to rent a bike for me. The code worked, so he entered the 6-digit code from my bike into his app, and the app told him he had those 10 seconds to unlock the bike. I've mentioned a few times it was a bit of a struggle to yank the U-bar out, but this time it simply refused to come out. He could not get it out. Steve is quite strong, and he yanked it every which way, but it was not going to come out. It got Steve to start wondering, maybe it has to do with the timing, that 10 seconds, like when does a 10 second start? You don't really know. Did he try too soon? Did he do something wrong? Well, luckily, by this time, we had kept our customer support rep on the phone. I took over and I told her that while she'd been lovely and very helpful, I wasn't mean to her at all. We had now spent 26 minutes successfully spending $10 to only rent one usable bike and that we were done. She immediately told us she'd generate a refund to each of our accounts for the full $10, $5 each, and we would be on our way, albeit on foot. Now, it's altogether possible that you would have a different experience with Explore Bike Share because we did see a family of four merrily ride past us later as we trudged along on foot. But in our experience, the kiosk software has some big problems, the physical locks are difficult to remove, and the B-Cycle app gets easily confused on passwords and whether or not you have a bike in your possession. Like I said at the beginning, though, the woman on customer support was really lovely. Next up, we're going to hear from good friend of the show and frequent contributor Joe Duganzik of Smarter Home Life. Let's see what kind of gadget Joe's going to talk me into now.
Have you ever thought, you know, I really wish I could talk to my light switch? Well, you're in luck. Smart thermostat maker Ecobee just released a Wi-Fi smart switch with Amazon's Alexa on board called the Switch Plus. Now, Ecobee isn't completely new to this, quote, add Alexa to a wall-mounted smart home device game. In 2017, they introduced their latest generation thermostat, the Ecobee 4, also with Alexa integrated right on the device with far-field listening microphones and a speaker. So, a talking thermostat? Yep. And so now there's a talking light switch? Yes. Welcome to 2018. But seriously, there's definitely something to having a multifunction voice assistant device mounted at a convenient location on the wall. Remember the intercoms of the 70s and 80s? Merge them with the computer of Star Trek and then fast forward to today with Alexa and Google Assistant. One small problem with adding a voice assistant to potentially every room of the house is needing to find a place for a smart speaker or other integrated voice device to live. And some rooms don't need a great music listening experience like a full-size smart speaker. They probably would be perfectly fine with average sound quality and basic voice interaction. That's where a smart switch with a voice assistant makes sense. Okay, so what does this Switch Plus thing do? Well, first, it's a remotely controllable Wi-Fi smart switch that works with single switch applications. It does require a neutral wire, is perfect for lights and ceiling fans, but sadly does not include dimming. It has several sensors on board measuring light, motion slash occupancy, and temperature. The motion sensor can trigger the switch to turn on in a dark room and automatically turn off after no activity. And there's an onboard nightlight that can turn on when the room gets dark. HomeKit users gain direct access to the Switch Plus sensors for creating automations. Coming summer 2018, the temperature sensor on the Switch Plus can act as a remote sensor for Ecobee's thermostats, and there will also be a vacation mode feature available for automated lighting routines when you're not home. The Switch Plus works with a myriad of voice assistants and smart home systems, including Amazon's Alexa, Apple's HomeKit / Siri, Google Assistant and Google Home, SmartThings, and IFTTT. There's even an on-device, voice-controlled maintenance menu on the Switch Plus itself for restarting and resetting the device. Much more convenient than finding and flipping a breaker. Overall, I found the installation and setup of the Switch Plus to be simple and painless. Once it's linked to your Amazon account, you essentially have a full-fledged Amazon Echo right on your wall. And I couldn't discern any difference in Alexa's response time compared to my Echo devices. And I had immediate control of all of the different services and smart home devices I had previously set up on my Alexa account. Note that Alexa messaging, phone calls, and wake words other than Alexa are not yet available on these third-party Alexa devices. While the Switch Plus speaker didn't provide boombox-level sound, I wasn't expecting it to. It was nearly comparable in loudness to an Amazon Echo Dot, and the small speaker reproduced music that worked pretty well for general listening. I think podcasts would also be a pretty good fit for the Switch Plus. On voice recognition, I tested it from several points and distances in my small home, including speaking loudly in the opposite direction of the mics at a distance of about 20 to 25 feet away, and there was no problem with it recognizing what I was saying. Overall, I think the Switch Plus is a pretty good all-in-one smart home device, and I would recommend it to anyone wishing to start or grow their family of Alexa devices. At $100, it could get a little pricey to equip your entire home with Switch Pluses. Or would that be Switches Plus? Anyways, the device has a lot of technology on board, and it's a pretty decent value for what you get. For demos and more information on Switch Plus, watch my review video at youtube.com/smarterhomelife. I'm Joe DeGanzik from Smarter Home Life. Back to you, Allison.
Well, thanks so much for that, Joe. That's a really interesting solution. $100 is the price on this device, and I don't know, that's pretty steep. But I am a big fan of being able to walk into a room and having a light come on. And that isn't as easy when you've got a light switch, say, with a bunch of lamps in a room or, you know, something over your dining room table. That's a little harder to do. So maybe that would be worth it. I'm not sure I want to talk to it with Amazon, but I do like that it's compatible with HomeKit. That's for sure. It's worth looking into, though, and Joe does have a fabulous video on that. He's got a new set up, and it's extraordinary. He's got such great production quality with his video, so be sure to check out. There's a link in the show notes, but I also went ahead and embedded the video in the blog post for this, so go check that out.
Hi, this is George from Tulsa here to ask, how much computer do you need? Or phrased differently, how much will the computer you need cost? In terms of cost, it can be surprisingly little. All my work and personal computing needs are within the capabilities of my seriously obsolete 2007 MacBook Pro. Then, I gave up editing raw photos in the quad-core i7 MacBook Pro I bought to do that, and I don't edit video. In 2015, I began setting up Linux on Intel Nook systems for work, home, and to distribute to charities. They're great for general use computing. With Ubuntu and Linux Mint long-term support, they're kind of set and forget for years as they receive regular security updates. All that good aside, I did have a problem to be solved. Even without massive, clot-like Windows 10 updates, or Mac OS annuals with interim version iterations, I needed a Linux computer to test updates and new software without risking the stability of our computers in daily use. And I didn't want to spend a lot of money. Those criteria led me to Intel's 2018 Gemini Lake Nook running a new quad-core Pentium Silver CPU. The bare-bones Nook is $169.60, outfitted with 8 gigabytes of RAM and a 120 gigabyte Kingston SSD. The entire system cost $297. Linux and productivity software are free. Yep, this is a really inexpensive system, but don't discount its capability. The 10-watt CPU runs at 1.5 GHz, but can boost to 2.8. Intel's UHD 605 graphics simultaneously supports two 4K monitors through dual HDMI 2.0A ports. There's four USB-A format USB 3 ports and a full-sized SD slot. Additionally, there's gigabit Ethernet and gigabit Wi-Fi, a dual microphone array, headphone jack, microphone jack, optical stereo out, and even an infrared receiver. One review said it outperforms previous Nooks with i3 processors. In my own brief experience, I've been using it side-by-side with a maxed-out 2015 i7 Nook and not noticed the newer and much less expensive system lagging. There's many places at work and home for an inexpensive yet capable system, because it draws just 8.8 watts at idle, right down there with a nightlight. One example would be to use it as a 24/7 Plex media server. As to running Linux, I've installed both Kubuntu 18.04 LTS and the Solus rolling release that's continuously updated with the latest patches and software. To make changing distros and software easier, I replaced Intel's too short SATA connector with an extension I leave dangling outside the Nook case that makes changing SSDs and thus Linux distros really convenient. With 120 gigabyte SSDs at just $40, why not? I'm linking two reviews in Allison's show notes that, combined, go into more detail than I can here. The reviewers spend time talking about Windows gaming, as that seems kind of a baseline for what's acceptable. In no way is this Nook a gaming system, but it does run Windows games if expectations and frame rates are reasonable.
Thanks for that, George. That's really interesting. I've been seeing George post about these Nooks over on Google Plus quite a bit in our Google Plus community, podfeed.com/Google Plus, if you're interested. And I had never seen one. He put a link for the show notes or put an image in the show notes for us so you could see what it looks like. It's, man, that's tempting. That's so inexpensive. It might be a fun computer to play with and to get a handle on Linux for sure. Anyway, thanks again for that. And I want to give a big shout out to Sandy, Joe, and George for sending in these contributions because it let me have fun on the holiday weekend out in Memphis at that wedding and got to relax a little bit. And I really appreciate all of your help. But that is going to wind us up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions. You can always email me at allison@podfeet.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at Podfeet. Remember, everything good starts with podfeet.com, right? We already talked about Patreon, podfeet.com/Patreon. You want to join our Facebook group? podfeet.com/Facebook. Want to go over and see what George is doing on Google Plus? podfeet.com/Google Plus. Not the only one over there. It's a lot of fun still. And let's see, you want to join our Discord chat? podfeet.com/chat. And you want to get a handle on these Amazon affiliate links that I'm always yapping about? podfeet.com/Amazon. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. We will be back next week, I promise. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.